Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 491. I will be coming to New York to tell jokes at Caroline's May 1st through the 3rd. So you can go to nerdist.com/calendar or go to Caroline's website and get tickets. Come out. It'll be fun. There will be hugs. Also, at midnight today, which is the 12th of March, is a very special episode. Kyle, grab a microphone. I'm going to throw three names at you.
All right.
The first name?
Yes.
Jonah Ray.
Okay, I like... Sure.
The second... Is he mean to you?
No. Actually, we're as buddies as we've ever been. I just did his podcast. I love that Jonah Ray.
That still doesn't...
We publicly have to maintain a level of hostility because that's what people want.
Okay. Well, don't ruin the illusion.
Sorry.
Two. Matt Myra.
Ooh.
Panelist.
Okay.
Panelist number three. Who could round out that panel, do you think?
Let's see. You're hosting the show.
Yeah.
Is it Katie?
No, it's not Katie, but someone who almost feels like they're a part of the team. You ready?
Yeah.
The man I call Double Dubs, Will Wheaton.
What?
Yep. Will Wheaton. Matt Myra, Jonah Ray, at midnight.
Is this, Wednesday, March 12th. Is this Myra's first appearance?
This is Myra's first appearance,
And so I like that we've set up something directly from Star Trek next to him so that he will be distracted.
Yes, we had to throw Next Gen on there. It was either Will or, you know, we could have also tried to distract him by throwing, like, LeVar or Denise Crosby or Riker's beard.
Oh, that would have been good. I bet Riker's beard would have killed on those reviews.
Riker's beard would crush.
Could you have Riker's beard just read reviews at some point? Just a puppet of a beard?
Oh, that's a great idea. All right. Well, that's going to happen. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The 100 on the CW, which premieres Wednesday, March 19th at 9, 8 Central on the CW. It's been 97 years since nuclear Armageddon decimated the Earth, destroying civilization. So essentially, there's 400 inhabitants of 12 international space stations that were in orbit at the time. So now everyone's pretty much dead, Kyle.
That's a bummer.
Well, not quite yet.
Oh.
Because they take 100 juvenile prisoners and they send them to the Earth, as you would.
And then make them fight to the death?
Well, no, not quite. They need to go down there and make sure that's okay for everyone else. So they go down.
It's just essentially penguins pushing them off.
Yes, to test to see if it's okay. They're basically just sending a bunch of kids to their potential death to make sure that it's cool for the rest of the humans.
I love this year of sci-fi we're living in where we're just killing teens left and right.
Hunger Games. Wow, they really did run that girl through
and now we're just like, does the air give you cancer?
It could. You don't know. That's why they got to send those kids down
there. Watch the hundreds.
You know why? Because the kids are on the space station like, when are we going to play? Why is there no Angry Birds?
There's nothing to do.
So, you know what? You shut up or you're going down to test the atmosphere.
Whatever.
Get. Enjoy your escape pod. Or isn't it escape pod? What are they escaping from?
What would be the opposite of an escape pod?
Kyle, and the opposite of an escape pod would be a prison receptacle.
All right, I'll take that.
Because you're not...
I thought it created like a cyberpunk Buddhist cone or something there for a minute.
Oh, I don't know, but cyberpunk Buddhist cone would be a great name for a band.
Yeah.
Kyle?
Yes?
Survival isn't who you are. It's who you become.
Ooh.
And who have you become
since? I want to become Survivor Man because it's in his name.
Les! I love Survivor Man Les. Yeah. He really gets it done.
He really does. And can set up a camera while doing so.
We should have him on the podcast sometime.
Oh, yeah.
But you know who I'm excited about today, Kyle?
Ooh-hoo.
It's no secret. One of the defining movies of my youth was Revenge of the Nerds.
I've heard such things.
I have seen this movie hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. And so, as many people as we meet on the podcast that are of note, it's rare that it's actually not that rare. I'm just usually able to squash it down. But it still blows my mind that Curtis Armstrong was on the podcast today.
It was pretty goddamn cool.
He played Dudley Booger Dawson, and also Charles Dumas in Better Off Dead, which is another seminal movie for my youth.
Seen the movie in forever, and then when we did this interview, I went back and watched and was like, oh my god, I had forgotten this movie existed.
I'm real sorry your mom blew up, Ricky. Doctor said you just won't be able to eat any spicy foods for a while. Like, that fuck, between Revenge of the Nerds and Real Genius and Better Off Dead, and of course, you know, Caddyshack, Fletch, and some of the most quotable movies of all time in that span.
Yeah, it was a real golden era for that.
Animal House really ushered in an era of
to be
films.
Kind of a away from the pack, slovenly adolescent youth.
It made me. I wanted to go to Adams College when I was a kid. I'm like, I want to go to Adams. I want to stay in that. I don't. It's fine that they moved into a nice craftsman house, but I sure loved the dorm room when I was like 14 years old. I was like, well, that's what I need. That's what I want in my life.
I wanted their version of the Devo suit with the keytar real bad for a while.
My actual college wasn't that much different than what Revenge of the Nerds was. So, which, after a few years, you're like, oh, yeah, I got to live like this.
Just with less sexual assault.
With 100% less.
Substantially less.
100% less sexual assault. But Curtis Armstrong is a phenomenal storyteller, just a wonderful guy, and I love that he was.
And he looks good. He looks like Booger still.
He looks good.
Like you're just, oh man.
And he also just, you know, like, he has great stories about everything, and so I really, really, really enjoyed this podcast a lot. And also, I should remind you that King of the Nerds has its season finale tomorrow, Thursday, March 13th at 10 p.m. on TBS. So watch that as well. Had been suspicious about that show at first, but they are not doing what they are not attacking nerds the way that I was afraid that they would be. TBS did a nice job with it.
Gets that George Takei stamp.
So here we go, the Nerds Podcast number 491 with Curtis Armstrong.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I brought my laptop just so I could show you that my computer's little avatar is you, and has been for many years.
Wow, yeah. I am honored.
When I sign on, it's basically a shot of...
of me about to say, still nothing?
That's right, when you're getting him high, you're getting...
Oh, Booga, I don't feel a thing.
And then he falls off. And you're wearing the shirt that says, "Give me head till I'm dead."
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you are...
And someone's made a lot of money making "Give me head till I'm dead" t-shirts.
Did you guys just print those on the set? Or was that a shirt that someone bought?
It was the costume director. Costume director, I mean, designer. You know, I would just show up and there would be another... obscene television t-shirt, and that it worked that way. It wasn't any idea of mine, you know. I mean, when she showed up with High on Stress,
but I was very, because I moderated your panel when we showed Revenge of the Nerds at the Castro in San Francisco,
right?
And then a bunch of you, most of you guys were there, Robert Carradine and Julia Montgomery and.
Tim Busfield, Larry B. Scott,
yes.
Brian Tochi, and Andrew Cassess.
Andrew, who you would never recognize.
No, he looks biblical now. He has the massive beard and all.
He played Wormser, so you would never.
Oh, yeah, because he's.
See, that's the problem, is even between one and two, Andrew had grown up so much. And he had not yet sort of grown into his nose.
Yeah.
And so he looked so different, but he didn't look like himself. And everybody would ask him, he would tell me, everybody would ask him, why didn't they use you in the second movie? That is me in the second movie. And he looks that much different now than he did in the second movie from the first.
See, the parents, they should do the Michael Jackson thing and load him up with to stunt his, you know.
Did they do that?
Didn't they?
Did they?
I thought they. Didn't they?
Did they?
Did they? Really?
To keep his voice from breaking.
Did they?
Didn't they?
I don't know.
I think they did.
There is that thing that's common in a lot of Greek people of testosterone deficiency. And like a kind of like Annie Melnakis has it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like a kind of like it takes a lot longer for you to go through puberty. So like it's like there are types of like
characters. Yeah, but the Greeks tend to make up for it afterwards. Once it finally happens, then
it's,
you know,
all bets
it's full
are off.
Steam ahead.
I'm going to go with they offended the gods in some way.
Yes, that's right.
And we're punished.
Let them gestate for just a moment more.
Their father was Zeus disguised as a bull when he's tried to have sex with the mother. But what I was fascinated to find out when I moderated this panel was that it wasn't just a movie that you guys came on as actors. You all really participated in the story and the characters.
Well, we did, but it wasn't our idea to do that. That was something that they encouraged. We weren't expecting to do that, but then they flew us out a week or so early to Tucson, and that was the procedure. Was we would sit around the pool, and one by one we would get called in to meet with the writers and the director and talk about our character and, you know, what he was like or she was like and all of that. And so we wound up, and then once we got into, they were doing the rewrites, and then once we got to filming, we would wind up doing a lot of improvisation.
Oh, wow.
So lot of the movie, it surprises me, actually, when looking back on it now, how much of it is just made up.
That's incredible.
I've cited this movie several times, and I said this in the panel, that this was the movie that sort of helped me define who I was, because up to that point, I didn't know there was a grouping. I just thought, oh, I like these things. I like some things in life, and only three or four other people in my school also like those things, and then everyone else likes other stuff. Yeah. But I didn't know that that had a name or a label, nor did I feel any grand connection to any greater movement that was happening. And so when I saw that, I was like, holy shit, that's the fuck, but that's,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was like that sort of a moment.
Well, I think it also had that effect because I would get phone calls. For a long time, I still had a listed number because I was trying to make a point to myself, I guess.
And, hey, man, don't go Hollywood.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'm literally.
All right, I'll go a little Hollywood.
Here, I still had you could look me up in the phone book. And I would get phone calls from these guys who clearly were lonely, disenfranchised guys who saw that movie and thought, I want to be in that house with those people because that's my refuge, mm-hmm. that they would understand me, you know.
Yeah.
And that was, I think it was one of the strongest strongest power that movie had on people was that idea of if you're lucky, you can wind up in a nice house with a bunch of people who are just like you and have the same interests and have to fight the same battles.
Yeah.
You know, and you can do them together instead of alone.
But it is the sort of brains over. I mean, it was that idea. Movies like that and Real Genius are like, smart people making other people pay.
Well, yes, it is in a way. And then at the same time, you look at it and you go, well, panty raids.
yeah, I can't think of anything more.
Even though you know, pouring hot stuff on the jock straps doesn't take huge brains.
No, but it did impress UN Jefferson and got you into the Tri-Lam House.
It did. So. Well, I mean, you know, at least the panty raid was a cover to install audiovisual equipment, yeah. Which
that's
all,
really what,
is what nerds do. There
that
is
the
audiovisual
there
department.
Was basically having remote audiovisual
right.
In 1983 or 4? Remote audio surveillance.
Right.
Yeah. Now we take it for granted. Mm-hmm. At the time, mm-hmm. you had to go to Radio Shack or find...
There was no Radio Shack. You had to go to something else. I mean, I don't think Radio Shack even existed then.
Well, it was definitely a triumph technology.
Yeah.
I think the technological panty raid, I'm just trying to justify this in the best way possible.
It's hard.
No, because there was a robot.
Oh, the robot.
The panty raid was a red herring.
Yes, the panty. Yeah, if we could have done it without the panty raid, of course we would have.
Of course.
Sure.
But, well, anyway.
This is bullshit. Pan down.
Nice.
The ability to remotely pan down.
Come on. But between that movie and Better Off Dead, which was another movie that was a very seminal film for me,
but a lot gentler.
A lot gentler. I mean, it was really...
It was really dark.
It was dark, but it was a cartoon. Like, that movie, Savage Steve,
yeah.
You know, like, he's a cartoonist.
Right.
Like, having a movie that's essentially with live-action cartoon characters
that, you know, I mean, Charles Dumas was a fucking great,
yeah,
a great character.
But I mean, it was also the same. It was the same thing with Better Off Dead, because I mean, Savage has that quality which I adore, which is this, you know, this wonderful, odd humor that never becomes, it never becomes cloyingly sentimental.
Right.
It's always a little, there's sentiment to it, there's heart to it, but then there's the surrealism, which he did so well in, yeah, both of the movies, I thought.
Yeah, definitely.
And but that was, you know, that he was influenced a great, I was in that because of Revenge of the Nerds and Risky Business, because he was a fan of those two movies and he wanted me in his movie.
Oh, wow.
That's why I was there.
That's great.
And then we talked a little bit about that in San Francisco before we did the panel, but I was sort of heartbroken to find out that Cusack he's essentially disavowed those films.
Yeah.
And won't take any. Did you hear the story?
No. But yeah.
They shot Better Off Dead. And then, and I know this, Savage Steve told the story, I think actually up at Sketchfest a few years ago. They shot Better Off Dead, and they said Cusack was great. And then they finished it, and then it almost immediately went into One Crazy Summer.
And he had a deal to do two movies.
With Savage. Oh, wow.
The One Crazy Summer, which wasn't called that then, was supposedly a kind of sequel to Better Off Dead, and Cusack was already scheduled to do them.
Oh, interesting.
What was it originally called?
I think it was
Crazy,
like,
Summer.
It was like What I Did on My Summer Vacation. I think it was What I Did on My Summer Vacation.
Cool. Well, so while they're shooting One Crazy Summer, they're about to start shooting One Crazy Summer, they get this cut of Better Off Dead in.
Mm.
And so
they do a screening.
And so they do a screening, and then John I guess,
walked out.
Just walked
what?
Out of the screening, and then wouldn't
out.
Talk to anyone for the rest of the filming.
Was it all the same crew?
It wasn't that. It wasn't that bad. It was. I had thought that the screening was here, but wherever it was, he was so angry and so, I guess, disappointed. It was not the movie that he was expecting. I don't know. It seemed like the movie that I read, but he felt that it was juvenile or something, and so when I got to Cape Cod to shoot the second movie, he had already gone through this, and we talked about it briefly, but he didn't dwell on it. It was not that he was, you know, refusing to talk to people or anything like that. In fact, he would talk to Savage, but he would also not listen to Savage, and he would do whatever he wanted to do.
Oh.
And then after One Crazy Summer was done, that was it, and he wouldn't have anything to do with anything, and he wouldn't publicize the movie.
Whoa.
And all that kind of stuff.
I know, because he almost did the podcast about a year and a half ago, and we had a phone conversation. He was really nice on the phone, really nice in emails. And this in the back of my head, I was just sort of clawing at me like, oh, if he does the podcast, I'm going to want to ask him about it, but I don't know if he's going to want to talk about it. And yeah. I don't, you know.
Well, it would be interesting to see. I mean, it's possible. Somebody told me recently that he had signed a poster of Better Off Dead.
That's kind of huge,
you know,
then.
But, I mean, that was huge because he literally would not sign anything.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody would hand him it and he'd push it away.
Jeez.
He would not. It was like a cross in front of a
maybe
vampire.
There was just more going on that we don't understand, which is why I would want to ask him about it. But between that and One Crazy Summer and then Risky Business, Jesus Christ, you were in so many. And then Moonlighting, like so much of that period.
That was a good decade.
That was. I mean, you know, and also all really wildly different kinds of comedies. Like Risky Business was slick.
Yeah.
And One Crazy
and
Summer.
Darkish,
and
too.
Dark and yeah. slick and, you know, and really the kind of, I feel like that's when the entertainment industry really kind of started to realize like, oh, it's not just about adults. There is this teen,
you know, sort of, I mean, coming off Fast Times or,
you know. Yeah, I mean, there had been a bunch of, I mean, that wave had already started. But, you know, the difference between something like Porky's and something like Risky Business or even Revenge of the Nerds, it's pretty dramatic. So that, and Fast Times, of course, and, you know, a lot of those were all happening around the same time. And it was obvious, the thing about Risky Business that was different was it was shot like an art film. It was shot like a European art film.
Yeah.
And the first guy that Paul Brickman hired was a DP named Peter Sova, who was, I can't remember from where. I don't remember, in Europe, but somewhere he was European. But he was he had just done Diner, which was, you know, sort of an adult type of movie like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was how he got Risky Business. But then he started kicking when we were shooting, because he said, you can't do this. You're shooting this like, it's a sex movie. It's a sex movie. You shouldn't be shooting this like a, this is a teenage sex comedy. It's not an art film. Stop it. You know? And they would have these arguments, Paul, and, you know, Paul had planned this for 7 years and he knew every angle and everything, every music cue, everything. And he wound up firing him. And we wound up having three DPs on that movie.
No way.
Because then Ray Villalobos came in for a while to do it, and then Bruce Surtees came in at the end to finish it. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, but that was the thing, is that it was at a moment where things were starting to change. It was always possible for you to do teenage sex comedies, and it would always be possible, but it was also now possible to do it for adults.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? And have it look really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then have a fucking Genesis song playing with this really cool train.
Yeah.
It was a very good decade, but was it also? It also seems like all these projects had like one kind of sticking point to them as well, except for maybe Revenge of the Nerds. But then, because then with Moonlighting, was the Cybill Shepherd Bruce Willis thing as epic as, or was that blown up over the years?
I don't think it was blown up over the years. I mean, it's not something I dwell on that much because. It was what it was. I've never had that experience since.
Oh, that's good.
By the way, or before, where the atmosphere is so toxic because these people hate each other, but also don't want to be on this show anymore. You know? And the combination was pretty intense.
Which sucks because, you know, as I've said a million times, It's hard enough just to get a job and then have it go somewhere, and then it's like, come on, can we just enjoy this a little bit, please?
Look, that was entirely my position too. You know, I had started out as an actor on stage. I'd done, you know, like 8 years of stage work before I did Risky Business. So I had all of that time going from, you know, like off Broadway and regional theaters and dinner theaters and tours and all that kind of stuff. I know what it was like, you know, to not make good money doing something you love. And then you start doing movies and suddenly you're making money. And then I had done no television. I started, Moonlighting was my first TV show. And fuck! You know, I mean, it was like making a movie every week.
Yeah.
It was so well written and so well shot. And, you know, they had great people on it. And Bruce and Cybill were great. And Elise and all that. It was really terrific. And at the same time, these people are going... But I remember Bruce, first day, this is true, first day I was on the set, before I was officially hired, the first day I was on the set, Bruce is there, and I'm introduced to Bruce and Cybill. And Bruce and I start talking, and he says, so what are you doing here? I said, what do you mean? He says, you do movies. What are you doing television for? I said, I don't know. This seems like a good show from what I've, you know, been on already for a year and a half or something. And he says, man, if I could do movies, I'd be out of here so fast.
Oh, shit. Oh, no.
And now, this is 1980, what, 7, probably, at that point? So, you know, it's 3 years since since Revenge of the Nerds, 4 years since Risky Business, and I've done a bunch of movies which no one is going to be doing 30th anniversary screenings of it anywhere, in addition to the cool ones, were the ones that were really horrible. And so, you know, I'm thinking, well, what a weird thing. I mean, yeah, movies are great, but I knew at that point he must be making a, you know, good chunk of money on a show that's great and highly respected, and why would you complain?
Well, I think there's – I mean, look, you know, to hear – you came from the theater, you know, you've worked for 8 years, and so to you it was more about, I don't know, theater, film, television, whatever. As long as I enjoyed the process, like that's where the – but then it sounds like – he just wanted to be a movie star.
Well, he had started in the theater too, in off Broadway in New York, same time I was there. I never saw him, but I remember hearing about shows that he did in New York. So he had started there too, but he had started there and made a really big jump. And then, for me, it was a matter of years.
Would it be a dumb sketch idea to go back and reenact like the plays that he did, and they're all these insane, like Die Hard type plays?
Shoot out all the glass.
Yeah. Yeah. This is bad prop glass.
Yeah.
And blowing up.
Yeah.
So he did come for the theater.
Yes.
Yeah. Action theater.
Action theater.
Action theater. No. But no, he did True West. He did the Sam Shepard, yeah. He did True West, which he was not in the original cast, but he was in the replay. So, I mean, he did stuff, you know. I mean, he was around.
But I remember when...
But he was best known as a bartender.
That's right.
Because he and John Goodman hung out at this bar which I can't remember the name of it, but it was the big bar at the time. And Bruce was the bartender, you know, a very popular bartender at this place.
Wow. So that's he crazy. Just, whatever he does, he just, he's just.
Well, once we were doing Moonlighting, people would say, you're working with Bruce. I say, yeah, I knew Bruce from New York. I said, oh, what were you in with him? He said, it was the bar. He was the bartender, and he was great.
Well, he did those, was it Bacardi commercials? There was some sort did he do Bartles and James?
He sure did.
Mm-hmm.
It was Bartles and James?
That's the wine cooler.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you could crack open it.
Like, it was that really... I mean, he looked like a bartender. He really looked like a New York bartender.
Well, apparently he was. and very good at his job.
And so, was that ultimately... When did you start to realize in the run of Moonlighting, like, oh, we're fucked. Oh, he's going to go off.
It was because when I joined, it was still okay, kind of. So I would say 6 months in.
Oh, wow.
Something when it started to turn really bad. And then, people would just not show up and storm off and throw things and
damn
all that stuff. And so it would be back to my trailer, you know, for another 10 hours until they sent me home.
With no internet.
What do no you internet, do with your... No cell phone.
What do you do with your time?
You should have seen my trailer. My trailer was 3 deep in books. And a tape player.
Of course.
So I could listen to music. And that was it. I mean, that was all there was.
My God.
But my God, I got a lot of reading done.
Thank you, Moonlighting. Such I'm a better person now.
I'm a better read person, yes, thanks to you. Yeah.
Moonlighting allowed me to really absorb some of the classics.
That's right. I discovered the Russians during that.
I mean, I've been very fortunate that I've never really had that experience.
Yeah, well, it had a funny after effect on me, because when I was doing Moonlighting, I then went to do, at one point, I went to do Nerds 2 mm-hmm. in Florida. And so I remember this so vividly. So I'd been going through this nightmare at Moonlighting with them. And then I went and I'm shooting and I'm with my friends. You know, it's all the guys from the first movie. And we were shooting the first day, we were shooting a scene on a plane, an airplane. And I'm sitting at a seat in the airplane and I have something. And we'd done it in the master and they were coming in for my close-up. So all the guys had been pushed off of the plane and they were setting up. And they're like, okay, we're ready. And the first says, we're ready for... sending the guys, we're ready for Curtis's close-up. And I went, no, that's okay. I'll do it myself.
Oh.
And I remember so well this guy stopping and looking at me and then saying, it's okay. They're not going to mind doing your off camera.
Oh, man.
And I was so used to not having either of them be there.
Oh, weird.
That you always had to give your off camera, no matter who you were. The biggest guest stars they had, you know, they would come in, they would shoot Bruce and Sybil, two shot, singles, overs, Bruce and Sybil would leave, and then whoever it was who was there had to do their off-camera, close-ups to the, usually it was the script supervisor. Sometimes Elise Beasley and I felt so bad
that we
would go in and read with these people.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So they could actually have actors to read with. I mean, that was the way it was.
Did they get stunt people to do, like, their makeout scenes? How the fuck did they ever get the two of them together?
Well, that only happened at the end. And as you remember, that was a pretty angry... I mean, they were practically beating each other. And they did use stunt people for a lot of it. But that was the effect that it had on me, that once I left that environment, it was like having, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Sure.
Is that I was saying, time to bring in the other actors. No, don't bring them in. It's fine. I'll do it
Don't
myself.
Bother them.
Wow. But then you sort of calmed down a little bit on that. I mean, that was essentially...
Then
that
I said, like, what am I doing? I have to relax.
You were literally on vacation for Nerds in Paradise. You were literally
sort
on
of,
a vacation.
Yeah, kind of.
and then so what happened from there? Like, what was it...
Well, I went back to moonlighting and, you know, it got, you know, everything sort of went from bad to worse and then it was over, and I sort of was at sea for a little while. I mean, there was a bit of a hangover from that decade, because it really had started with me first getting the first regular work I had in the theater, doing interesting stuff, and then Risky Business, and then all of the rest of them, and then Moonlighting. That experience was so intense and so unpleasant. And I kept working, but, you know... Yeah, I was, you know, I went through a divorce at that point.
Oh, geez.
I mean, it was like everything was not good.
So you were coming out of the 80s the same way that most people were.
Yeah. That's
coming
right.
Out of the 80s, just like, how much drugs did we do?
Yes, exactly.
What happened?
Right. Yes.
Who was president? Like, it's just sort of like, what the 90s were really like.
Looking back on it, it's just this blur.
You can imagine, it's like coming into the 90s where it's like, glam rock, like, all of the politics are different. Everything changes, and it's grunge. And it's so you imagine people emerging from the 80s just, like, wiping the coke off their face, coming out of these neon clothes.
How long,
like,
were we in there?
What the fuck happened? You okay?
Yeah.
You all right?
Is daylight already?
I don't know, man. I don't know where I am.
It's
Who
so
are
true.
You?
Yeah. It's so true.
So when you were doing, did you ever want to go, did you ever go back to the theater?
Oh, I was still in the theater then. I mean, I, you know, on summer hiatus, I would go do plays back east, and I never stopped. I continued to do plays up until the last one was about 7 years ago, which was a Sam Shepard play, oddly enough.
Bringing it around. Was it difficult to, I mean, because you probably don't expect, I mean, you know, when you do a movie and it's like, oh, I'm just an actor, I'm hired to do this as the character, and then all of a sudden it's like, booger! Like, everywhere you go, does that sort of get in the way of the theater stuff when you're like, no. I'm another... Okay,
not
good.
Really. I mean, a lot of the people who come and see me in a play are not going to be, you know, necessarily... you know, guys.
I can't wait to see Booger and Death of a Salesman, bro. It's going to be the fucking best.
You're not going to see that. You're not going to be seeing.
You're just, I am Willie Loman in the background. Hair pie. Like, come on. Please keep this. Please be silent for the.
Yeah. No, that never happened for that. I mean, that has happened in my life.
Of course.
But it doesn't happen when I'm doing a play.
Almost worse when it's in your life. Where you're like, you're on a date and some, oh, please, can I just live my, please.
Or, booger! I mean, the guys. Yeah. You know, with no neck and, you know.
I was so delighted to, which I did not know before, that the someone asked you about the belch.
Mm.
The infamous belch, and you said... that it was, in fact...
a camel orgasming.
They took the sound.
What?
It is the sound of a camel orgasming. Because they couldn't find anyone on the planet who could do the belch the way they wanted it and as long as they wanted it. And so they started looking at recordings of the animal kingdom. And they found, and Busfield was there when they, this is the only reason I know it, is Busfield was there when they were doing post. And he, they said, listen to this. It's the sound of a camel orgasming. And the thing that's amazing about it is that somebody actually said, you know, one place we haven't looked, animal orgasms. Where's that album? You know?
I think Nimoy released art thing that someone...
Oh, my God.
Just someone going, well, you know, like if anyone says, well, you know, and then that comes up, like, well, how would you, why would you ever... And this was not at a time where... the whole world of everything was available at our fingertips.
No, it was on, you know, it was on long playing records and that kind of thing. And they went, well, you know, there is this camel orgasm, which might be what we want.
The camel orgasm's like this. The gorilla orgasm's like this.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Give me another chance.
Well, the funny thing to me about, like, would you sort of make that point earlier about, like, but they really were doing panty raids. But it's where, but the way that Lewis wins Betty over is he almost, it's a little gray. It's a little gray. It's
I don't know if it's even gray, really.
Okay, it's very dark. But just the idea that when he comes up that she doesn't go, well, you're under arrest.
That's how good he was, Chris.
Or the fact that they wouldn't get expelled for putting pictures of her tits in the bottom of a pie tin.
Yeah. Right.
But at the time, as a kid, I was like, I'm in. I'm in for all of it.
Yeah. Well, of course you would be.
Yes, of course.
But, I mean, it was one of those things where, even at the time, there were moments where I was looking at what we were doing and on the one hand had this, you know, really fairly progressive, you know, message, which is what that movie really is about. I mean, that's what it was always intended to be about. The writers were intending a metaphor for prejudice and tolerance and so on. And there are those things, you know, so that on the one hand you've got You've got this group of guys who accept a gay man into their group without any question, and at the same time, you're playing the gay man as the most outrageous, you know, stereotype. I mean, it's so beyond, you can't even believe it.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things like the business with Betty on the Moon,
right,
and those kinds of things where, you know, in the panty raid, you know, there are things that were very much of its time,
sure,
when it came to how you depicted minorities or how you depicted women and all that kind of thing, which we were not on board the bus at that point. Mm. But hopefully, you know, most of it is still accepted as, you know, well, we meant well.
It would be a much... I had heard titterings of like, oh, they're going to remake Revenge of the Nerds, or there's going to be...
They tried. They did.
They did remake it?
Well, they started it.
And then it didn't. It fell apart. It would be a totally different movie now.
They pulled the plug on it. The network, the studio canceled it.
Oh, good.
Like 3 weeks into shooting.
Oh, wow.
Good.
They actually had the script. Robert read it. They had a script... I can't remember. I'm not going to even guess who the director was. He was somebody I'd heard of. And they cast it, and they went to Duke University. And that was where they were shooting it, at Duke.
Oh.
And, right. So they, now, Duke has not read the script, apparently, or read a watered-down version of the script, because they were in the process of going through that gang rape trial.
Sure.
Right? And... suddenly somebody finds this script and goes, do you realize we are going through this gang rape trial and we're allowing this garbage to be filmed here? And it was apparently extreme. I mean, that script was the sex and the I mean, it was,
were you guys,
as you
involved
would imagine,
with it in any way?
No,
of course not.
Not at all.
Good. Because not everything needs to be remade.
No. And in fact, when we heard, we just were kind of, oh, geez, really?
Yeah.
And because you know that from anything in the 40s, whether it's horror, in the 80s, whether it's horror films or sex comedies or anything else, what has happened in the interim, you know, the R that Revenge of the Nerds was, the R now, mm-hmm. you know, would be just...
And the sex comedies of the 40s.
Yes. I mean, they were...
I'm going to get you when you sleep in a different bed.
That's right. No. That's right.
You're going to be expecting a toddler. There's no...
No.
There's nothing you can...
No.
Look at
you go from 0 to 60 and then 60 to 500 and...
I mean, it is pretty remarkable. It is pretty remarkable. But it really was...
Never happen again.
It'll never happen again. No, it'll never happen again. It was very much of its time.
Yeah.
Even the whole, I don't even think you'd get away now with what the fuck is a frush now.
No, I mean, it would.
Brian was hilarious about it at the panel.
Yeah.
He's really funny guy.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. That was, again, what the fuck is a frush came out of an improv that he and I did because there was nothing for us to shoot at that moment. And so he and I had been told by the director, we were on the cots next to each other in the gym, to come up with something. And he went to shoot Bobby and Anthony, and then he came back and we'd gotten a deck of cards and we just started doing that routine. And that was what wound up being the running gag with Booger and Takashi, is Booger is constantly screwing with Takashi. And it all came out of that.
Oh, that's great.
So when you started in the theater, what types of roles did you like?
It wasn't a question of like or dislike. I mean, I studied at an academy which was an English classical tradition sort of academy of dramatic arts, a 2-year course at a place in Michigan, and that was my training. And then I went into whatever I went into. If it was Shakespeare, I did Shakespeare. If it was Neil Simon, I did Neil Simon. I would do Pinter or Arthur Miller or whatever. And I had, you know, a long string of various types of plays, and that was what I was going to do. I didn't think it was ever going to be different. And when Risky Business came along, it was such a shock because, I might have told you this before, but during Risky Business, I kept a journal every day because I wanted to remember what making a movie was going to be like.
Because you never thought it would happen again?
Right. That's exactly right.
Have you looked at the journal recently?
I have.
How does it hold up?
It's interesting. Now, what's interesting about it is not that it would be able to inform me about the process of movie making, but what's interesting is what I write about other people.
Oh,
which
shit.
Is the most, you know, most fun thing.
Were you auditioning for movies during that time?
A couple of times I did, yeah, for a few. I remember one that I auditioned for was Lady Hawk. That Matthew Broderick got.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had auditioned for that. And, you know, probably a few others. I don't remember exactly now.
Yeah.
The biggest one was Amadeus. that was later on. And I had auditioned for the Broadway play because I'd been in an off-Broadway play which had done well. So I had first auditioned for Peter Shaffer on the stage of the Broadhurst Theater. And it was so thrilling. It was so thrilling. I mean, he came down and, you know, I would do a scene and he would come down and he would talk to me about the research he'd done on Mozart. He said, you realize at this point in his life, and it was such one of the great auditions ever. Didn't get it. Then they were making the movie. I was brought in. I went to Milos Forman's apartment on Central Park, overlooking Central Park, and just sat with him. And read with him, and then wound up doing a screen test with Christine Ebersole in New Jersey right after that, and did a whole bunch of scenes in full costume and makeup and the whole deal. And that all exists somewhere because he never let go of anything. But that was the closest I came to a career-making role and didn't get. But you know what? It was so amazing, and it was such an incredible experience.
Yeah.
I never had a chance to regret it. It was just, wow, that was something.
I mean, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, at a certain point, especially with acting. If you get really close, this is what I tell people. I've told you this before too. When you're auditioning, if you start consistently getting close, that really says, like, you're good enough for this job. You're on the right track. And in the end, if you don't get it, a lot of times it's for reasons that don't have anything to do with you.
Yeah, but I think also people can have trouble with that. And if you don't have the determination and you don't have the patience, the fact that you come that close and lose it a few times is enough, can be enough for some people to just drive them out of it.
Oh yeah, there's no question. But I also feel
they weren't meant to be there in the first place.
Yeah, that's right.
Clearly.
Because I feel like if you are really, really, really obsessed with doing something, then nothing
right.
should, I mean, not nothing. I mean, obviously, you know, if you get hit by a train, but I mean, most things would not keep you from it because you'd go, well, I'll just figure it out. I don't give a shit. I mean, like I had that for years where it was just like, you know, I would test 3 or 4 times a year for pilots and it's like, oh, I got Chloe. I think I'm going to get it. Oh no, they gave it to Zoe. Oh, I got to give it, you know, and just constantly that up and down. And you know,
see, that's funny because that still happens to me. I'm not joking. I cannot get cast in a pilot to save my fucking life to this day. I will, if I go in for an audition for a pilot, it will get right to the network and then.
And then, but usually it's the, you know.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it reached a point where I went, okay, well, this is clearly not where I'm meant to go.
Sure.
I'm meant to, you know, come in as a guest star and then they keep me.
Yeah.
Because
or just
if it's up to the network, they will never allow
it. Or the right thing. Or the right thing has to come along.
But, I mean, you know, I'm a character actor and really, being in that kind of a role that would carry something on television, I don't see. But, you know, it's just amazing how that kind of thing can happen. And you do hit a wall after a while where you go, all right, well, I'll just stick to what I'm doing because that's crazy.
But I also, you know, so we sort of had this conversation with Christopher Lloyd, too, about, like, someone, there's a Deadwood-style role where someone's kind of, like, you're going to put you in it, and people are going to be like, oh, my God, and then be so blown away because you're a fantastic actor, and they're going to see you doing what you've been training to do your entire life.
Well, the funny thing was, I sort of was hoping that was going to be what happened with Ray, because Ray was me doing a role, the role of Ahmet Erdogan, and doing something where I looked nothing like myself. It was like the dramatic role in an Academy Award-winning movie that would be the one that would help people over the hump and say, well, it turns out everybody thought it was Clint Howard because I shaved my fucking head and suddenly everyone says, man, could you believe Clint Howard in that fucking movie? I had no idea. That was me, damn you! That was me acting!
Can you keep it down? We're talking about Clint Howard over here. So anyway,
you see the ice cream man? Oh, shit!
How great was Clint Howard as Chaka in Land of the Lost?
He was great in Westworld, just to keep on messing up.
No, but I mean, it was like finally I'm doing something that is so far from me that I was really in that zone, you know, where I was shaving and the whole deal.
Yeah.
And it was too far away. And no one said, oh, look what Curtis Armstrong said.
So they didn't connect that. They didn't
know it was me.
God damn it. Well, now they'll know. Mm. But I do. But there is such a, you know, there is this sort of television renaissance that's happening, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, I really, really, really feel like I know it feels like, so close, but it's just because the right thing.
Yeah. No, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, that's not even what I'm talking about. I'm having fun with this. But the truth is, I look back on my career. It's, you know, 40 years since I started in the theater. So I'm looking at this and thinking, I could not have asked, literally could not have asked for a better career. My career has been fine. And I don't regret the fact that no one has ever cast me as a serious dramatic actor. It doesn't matter to me. The point is, I have continued to work. I've continued to enjoy what I'm doing, you know, for the most part. and you know, that's it. I mean, it's as long as, and, you know, the fact that at 60, I am working more than I was when I was 40. And in fact, more than I was when I was 20. So I guess
that's awesome.
It's got to be okay, you know, at that point.
How's King of the Nerds been?
King of the Nerds has been the most fun. I mean, I never dreamed I would be in a reality show ever. I mean, it was just so far from my plan. But Robert Carradine and I came up with this idea a few years ago, and we were able to sell it to TBS. We're in our second season now, and we're hoping momentarily to get a pickup for a third.
Nice.
And there is something unique about this experience. It's not acting, obviously, but I'm, as an executive producer, the experience is a lot of fun, seeing it from the other side, from casting and budget meetings and challenge meetings and, you know, all of the stuff that you're involved with when you're a producer of something. And I love the nerds. I just love the damn nerds, both seasons. I want to take all of them home.
Well, that makes me happy because I didn't know, just when I heard the show was first, I didn't really have a lot of details on it. And I kind of got a little suspicious. I'm like, they're not fucking making fun of nerds, you know, because just that Hollywood has never really known, the entertainment business has never really known exactly what to do with the nerd cluster. And in the 90s, like in the old days, it was very much a derisive, they're butt of the jokes,
yeah,
they're, you know, and so and everything is, you know, things have changed now,
well,
a bit. And
yeah, and two things about that. One is that what Robert and I said to everybody we talked to, and I continue to say to this day with the people, our production partners and so on, is if you ever don't know what you're doing with this show, go back and watch the last scene in Revenge of the Nerds.
Mm-hmm.
Because that encapsulates the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's the tolerance, it's the acceptance, it's the nerd values, it's the whole deal. And that's one thing. Second thing. First season, we're looking at people to invite to be guest stars, nerd celebrities,
yep,
basically. Top of everybody's list is George Takei.
Yep.
I mean, oh my. You know, I mean, oh my.
Oh my.
And George is, you know, people, whenever we approach them, would say yes or no for whatever reason. Not George. George said, well, I will do it, but only if I'm assured that they're not mocking nerds.
Oh, you just love George Takei.
And the casting director said, well, no. That's the whole idea, is that we celebrate the nerds, not mock them. And he said that he appreciated that because, to some degree, he said, my career is thanks to nerds, and I'm not going to be part of anything that makes them look stupid.
He's the loveliest guy in the world.
And, of course, he came back this season, not just as a guest, but as a challenge. He became last week's challenge, freeing George Takei. So this was, I mean, you know, from one of the great nerd icons of our day, it was quite a wonderful
thing. The first time I met George, I said to Kai, even though I knew it was Takei, because I was so nervous.
Yeah.
I was like, George Takei, I mean, and he goes, no, it's pronounced Takei. It rhymes with gay. As in, it's okay to be Takei. That's what he said to me. I was like, I fucking love this guy.
That's
so much.
Wonderful.
That's, yeah. Right.
When
yeah.
was that?
This was a couple years ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, you know when I met him for the first time? Do we have a second?
Sure, we have time.
First time I met him, Detroit, 1973. They had the first Star Trek convention ever to be held in the city of Detroit, and one of the, I'm sure it was relatively few at that point in the country. And I went, being a big Star Trek fan, I went down there, and it was so small that it was held literally in three rooms at a hotel.
What year did you say this was?
73.
73. Holy shit!
73.
Proto nerds.
I know. And I went down there. I was going to the academy at the time. And I went down there, and one room was Hawker's room, and there was nothing. I mean, they hadn't they had nothing to show.
Yeah. Nothing. What was
being
made?
What were you hawking in 1973? Then they had a room where all day they had a projector up, running like 16 millimeter prints of the show.
Holy shit!
Including the much rumored blooper reel, which I saw for the first time in that room. And then the last room was where the cast was. And the people who came to this thing were George, Walter Koenig, and James Doohan.
Oh, wow.
And the three of them are in that room, and there's nobody there. I mean, you know, people are trickling in. They finish watching the they come in and they buy a poster and they have them sign the poster. But it was the most thrilling moment for me to be in that room with them. And because there was no one there, the turnout was so terrible, there was nobody there, so you could just sit there. You know, you'd sit there and lean up against the table and talk and say, you know, in that episode, you know, and they would just talk and talk and talk, and it was a big thrill.
I wonder if George ever leaned over and said, someday hundreds of thousands of people will be here.
Yes,
no, right. Come on.
Well, I think, imagine. I mean, they've been flown from Los Angeles to Detroit, and they get there, and there's nobody there. And then, you know, you fast forward a decade or two, and you can't get in.
Shit gets crazy.
I just thinking about the idea of being a proto-nerd in those days and walking into a room and seeing a blooper reel, which you may have heard about or even if you didn't know about it, and then knowing, like, as soon as I walk out of this room, I may never see that again.
Oh, that's right.
Of just trying to absorb every... I've got to remember every second of it. Every second of it.
That's exactly right.
Because we don't have the internet. You can't take it for granted.
For me, I still hadn't seen the entire first series because I had been living overseas. I came back in 67, which was the year it went off the air. So I was catching, you know, the reruns of that last summer. I had never seen the pilot, you know, the Captain Christopher Pike thing.
Because you had to...
I'd never seen any of them.
Video. You just had to get lucky to get hit in the face with it.
Yeah. And when it went off of syndication, when they stopped running the reruns, you were fucked. You didn't see it. But I remember that blooper reel of going, this is... godlike. I'm seeing Captain Kirk fuck up his lines. I mean, the idea of such a thing didn't exist. It was
James Tiberius.
It's Kirk.
Yeah. Come on. He always knows the score.
They're laughing. They're laughing like human beings. I mean, it was amazing.
That must have been cool as an actor, too, to just see these kind of, you know, larger-than-life figures and then go and just see them behind a folding table.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, they're just guys?
Yeah. Well, no, that was not the same. It wasn't like that because they were not just guys. They were the crew of the USS Enterprise.
Does stuff like that sort of mold or help inform who you are when people get fan out? Because you're incredibly personable and really sweet, and you seem... Like, if someone just came up, you'd go, hey, how's it going?
Yeah.
You know, like, does that help?
Yeah, it does help because, you know, I've seen both sides of that and how it can be with people who are really horrible and people who are really nice. I've been very lucky. The people that I've met whom I've admired have always been really, you know, lovely, generous people with their time and so on. And they don't get mad at me because I'm a fan of theirs or anything. I like that and I appreciate that. And on the other hand, I've seen the other thing, which is just too horrible to imagine.
Do you ever find sometimes? I find sometimes that I try to make up for other experiences, or I've seen at Comic-Con like people get blown off by famous people that I liked before, and I happen to be in the vicinity, and I'll like try to save it somehow. Like, oh, hey, come on, let's all, you know, like just try to, so that they don't come away from that experience feeling like, oh man, that guy that I really liked was really shitty, you know, like just trying to distract him or something.
Sure, believe me, it is something that you feel, because why do you do that? What is the point of doing that? You know, I mean, I talk to people all the time, you know, who've been working with people who are very famous people, and some of them I have worked with, and, you know, They are so mean. They're mean to, you know, these women who are, you know, assistant costume designers and, you know, third, you know, production assistants and stuff. And they're yelling at them. Why would you do that? What does it really make you feel that much better to be shitty to people?
No, I think they're just unhappy to begin with. And it just like, blah, yeah. blah, blah, blah. That's just how it comes out.
It's part of what it's there anyway. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. It is there. And when you get to a certain point and you don't have to be nice to people anymore, then you say, I've been nice to people. Now I'm going to just blow them off because I don't care.
Sure. Well, you also have to keep reminding yourself that you're really lucky to be doing what you're doing. And
That's
then
right.
also what it was like when you didn't get to do these things, you know, so it's,
no, I know. There's
a responsibility to not be a fucking total cock because yeah. you just have to make sure that, you know, because I think it's a slippery, I think it can happen before people realize it's happening.
I always think also that for me, because I'd started in the theater and I didn't make Risky Business until I was almost 30. So Risky Business, I'd already had a work ethic imbued in me. I'd already, you know, I was a grown-up mm-hmm. at that point, to the extent that any man is a grown-up at 29. Mm-hmm. I was one. So then, you know, whereas if you were making Risky Business today, you would cast it with, you know, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. Sure. You wouldn't cast it with a cast of people who are 29 and 30 years old.
No, you'd put Zac Efron and then Jonah Hill.
Well, they're already actually too old for that. But at the time, yes, that's what you did.
Yeah.
Is you would, you know, because that's what they do now. And then those people are getting all of the money and all of the women and all of the drugs and all of that kind of stuff is going on. And if they can manage it, God bless them. But I don't know how.
It's tough. Yeah. I don't either. I don't know how anyone maintains. Well, I guess that most people don't.
Well, at least they fuck themselves up for a while, at least. But it's hard. I mean, you know, when you're that age and you're getting all of that attention and all of that spotlight, and you can't do anything wrong, and you can't do anything for yourself. You've essentially gone from your parents' house to the house of CAA or whatever it is, where everything is done for you, and you don't know how to get to the airport if you're not being driven. Yeah. All that kind of stuff. I mean, what kind of a fucking life is that? I don't know.
Well, it's almost it's almost not even their fault because
it isn't.
It is to a degree, but it's also not because it's like, oh, this is what they've been conditioned to. This is what they think life is, and
right.
then when it gets taken away, then, you know, then shit gets really crazy.
Yeah.
Really, really dark and crazy.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it is that is one thing that, you know, if someone who's really young is like, oh, I really just want to make it, is like, you know, if you make it a little bit later in your life,
that's okay too. Yeah.
That is way okay and maybe better.
Yeah. I would say that's probably true.
Because it's just too hard. It's just too hard to navigate. And especially in, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, where it's not, we weren't really as socially conscious as we are now.
No.
And didn't really give a shit, like, oh, yeah, fuck that guy. You know, he didn't, whatever, he didn't show up for work. Oh, he's dead. Fine, whatever, who cares? You know, now it's like, no, we need to kind of help people and foster them and hold their hand a bit more and let them get therapy and help. And, you know, like, I feel like, we're not perfect, but I feel like we're a little bit better now than we were.
Maybe,
back then.
Maybe. I mean, I had done a movie in. I remember this is an interesting angle on that. I was doing a movie in Spain in 1985 with Alan Arkin.
Oh, wow.
Which what movie were we doing with Alan Arkin?
Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
And it was the most exciting thing because I adored Alan Arkin, and I remember we were on a bus going to a location. And the director is on the bus, and we're waiting, and we're late. And he's going, what's the matter? What's going on here? Harvey Miller, his name was. He died a number of years ago. But what's going on? Why are we waiting? And this woman comes out of the hotel, and she's holding one of our makeup women who's sobbing and hysterical. And Harvey goes, what's going on? And somebody jumps up and says, Harvey, this is terrible, but her sister was on a plane that just took off from Madrid and crashed.
Oh.
And she doesn't know. And Harvey says, was any of our film on it?
Oh, no. Oh,
and the producer was there and said, Harvey, you don't mean that. He says, I do mean that. I don't know these people. And I've always remembered that as sort of an interesting thing to try to avoid.
Yeah. I feel like you're safe at this point. You're probably not going to be...
Oh, yeah. No.
You're probably not going to be any of our film on the camera guy.
I think no one on the bus was capable of that.
Yeah.
Except Harvey.
Oh,
and you
man.
Sort of had to know Harvey to appreciate it. But he was... That was... You know, the people are people. And it's a weird situation, but...
So what is it that you're, you know, what's your sort of takeaway from everything? I mean, it's the idea that you're working more than you had before at age 60 and you're totally appreciative of your career. Like when you sort of look back and go, aha, like what's your ultimate takeaway from everything?
I think it took me a long time to realize I had a career. I didn't realize I was going from one thing to the next, and I was too focused on whatever it was I was doing to realize how lucky I was that I was still doing things. And I was actually doing a show with an actor who he'd asked what I was doing, and I said, not much. I'm doing this thing and this thing, but, you know, it's not, you know, and I was sort of denigrating what I was doing at that point. It was in the 90s sometime. And he said, why do you do that? Why don't you realize you have a career that people my age would give anything to have? You know, you don't... I mean, he completely took me down and made me realize what... Which I hadn't intended, but I realized what I sounded like. And a lot of the times now that I look back on a career that has lasted this long, I realize there have been times where I've been unhappy with the trajectory of it or the speed with which I was going from whatever it was, and how ridiculous it is and how small it is to think of it in those terms. And now, as a result of being able to open my head up to that a little bit, I look back and I go, fuck. That was a good career. I mean, to the fact that it's still going on now and I've had that wonderful run of all sorts of different things, you can't beat that.
Now, the only thing that could have made that speech more poignant and better is if you looked at us and then opened your mouth to unleash a camel orgasm burp.
And believe me, if I could do it, I would.
I mean, people must have been putting you on the, do it, do the burp. No, I can't.
They still do.
Do it. No, I didn't. It wasn't.
A woman did it in San Francisco. Remember
San
that?
Francisco.
She had this woman stood up and said, I can beat you in a belching contest.
Well, that's why you told the story, yeah.
And I said, you could, actually. I don't know how you belch, but I don't.
Yeah. I'm actually a camel in disguise, and I'm about to come. well, Curtis, where can people? Are you on the tweets? Or
I'm on the tweets. I'm on I'm Curtis's booger.
Nice.
And now I want to make sure you understand. It's not possessive. It's not Curtis's
Curtis
booger.
Is.
It's Curtis. Is mm-hmm. booger one
Kurt, verb of being.
Kurt is booger.
Oh, now I'm confused.
So
Curtis is booger.
He's on Twitter on at Clint
Curtis
Howard.
Right.
Oh,
at Clint Howard.
But it's been really great having you here. And good.
Thank
good,
you
and
so
good
much.
Luck with, good luck with King of the Nerds, and we hope to have
Thursday
you back
nights.
Thursday nights on TBS.
On TBS, very funny.
Are you guys at? Are you at 8 o'clock?
We're at 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock. 10 Thursday
o'clock.
Nights, 10 o'clock. TBS. King
of the Nerds. Thank you so much. It's
yes.
been great, great fun. I really
so
appreciate it.
So good to see you, man. So good to see you
Thank
again.
You.
It's, I mean, honestly, if you have any idea, for lack of a better term, how much I was nerding out over meeting you and the rest of the guys and sitting and talking to you, I mean, like, you, honestly, so many things that were a part of what defined me when I was growing up and that I identified with were things that you were a part of. So it was, you know, like, this really means the world to me, and
I appreciate
it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, man. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Cool.
Nice.
Thank you, everybody. That was really fun.
Absolutely.
Really fun.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.